want to welcome you into episode number 5 of the Main Rundown podcast. As always, I'm Zach Tarenko, along with my co-host, Jeff Christianberry. Jeff, the rain is starting to come. The snow is on its way. How are we feeling about the weather?
I mean, it's one of those, it's interesting because, like, it's basically Thursday is going to be a lock for snow day, which is kind of, I mean, I don't want the snow, I'd rather not, but when you get to this point, you're like, all right, I can kind of plan my week around Thursday, definitely having it off, and Friday, who knows, we'll see. Hopefully it's, again, you're going to get mostly rain here. We're worried about the winds. We're worried about the not so much the snow, but the mix that we're going to get. So, yeah, it's an April surprise. I'd rather just have it in January. It's going to put off golf for another week or two. But next week, it'll be in the mid-60s. So it'll melt quick. But, yeah, not very fun. Good time to sit inside and watch sports.
Yeah, literally. I'm supposed to head home this weekend just to, you know, see my family for a little bit, and I'm now having to face the fact that the train that I'm supposed to take might get canceled because I don't think the one from Connecticut to South Station won't be canceled. I don't think, because that's mostly just rain. But North Station to Saco on that Downeaster, the Downeaster is very, very commonly known to cancel trains early and sometimes for no reason. So I'm hoping I can get home. Worst case scenario, my parents can come pick me up. We'll see. I haven't even told them that they may have to pick me up, but we'll see how that goes. Hopefully, yeah, the weather has just been not my favorite, but we're heading towards the better part of the spring and the summer, so all good things, especially with sports. So why don't we just head right into the rundown segment, get right to it, and I'll have you start off with your first topic of the week.
Yeah, this one's going to be about the NCAA tournament. Interesting weekend of games that we just had. I'm going to focus on Duke. I'm a Duke fan. Rough loss to NC State. Just a pretty pathetic overall offensive performance. The first half was okay, but only is kind of overshadowed because NC State also shot very poorly. But Duke just had nothing offensively. It was just, you know, it's the Duke that we saw sometimes during the season where you just like they're way too talented for this. So. And on the other hand, NC State, one of the best runs in the history of college basketball between the ACC tournament and now. So part of me is like, well, you lost to a team that's on a magical run right now. Now I think they're going to get waxed by Purdue. I think it's going to be Purdue, UConn in the championship, and UConn will probably win. But my focus on this topic is Cooper Flagg. Now that we can finally say Duke season is over, it's now officially the Cooper Flagg era coming to Duke. They need him. I mean, we're talking, they need him because if you looked at that team, they played a great game against Houston. They played great in the first two rounds of the tournament too. And you saw the glimpses of it. Now, who could they have coming back? You know, Jared McCain, Jalen Blakes, Tyrese Proctor, Cal Filipowski, all those guys are underclassmen. Definitely could see one or two of those going pro or trying to go pro. You know, I was not overly impressed with Filipowski, what I saw. He missed a shot against Houston, a 7-footer shot that would have clinched that game. They ended up winning the game anyway, but he was almost a non-factor in the NC State game. And same with Proctor and McCain, hot and cold a little bit. They had some outside shooting, and obviously Filipowski is kind of a big man inside, but they didn't have that dynamic score that could create off the dribble. Right. So they need those guys that can drive the lane and either dunk it or throw it out for three. So I'm super excited now that they have a base. Now that it's 2 years for John Shire under the belt as a coach, as a Sweet 16 appearance and Elite Eight appearance. So no complaints there. But Cooper Flagg is needed in this team. But what's interesting, too, is the only kind of nod I'll put in there is we'll see what happens with the transfer portal. So I saw a stat or a graphic on X about the Elite Eight teams, and they had their starting five and what school they started at. Okay. And Duke had all their starters started at Duke. Mm-hmm. And I think they were the only team that had that. Most other teams, you know, there's a couple of teams that had all five guys that started somewhere else to start their career. So that's just the way it is. You know, it's a transfer portal era. We'll see if Duke can kind of dip into the transfer portal, get a little bit better, especially on the inside, because once Filipowski goes out, they had no offensive weapon underneath. So we'll see what happens. And look, the teams that are winning now aren't freshman-laden. They are guys, they're teams that have some good freshmen, but also some experienced guys that are transfers. So I think Flagg is going to fit in great. And I just can't wait to see him. You know, I'm sure he'll go on campus soon once the spring hits, and it's going to be a fantastic next year for the main product.
Yeah, I agree. All great points there. And you hit on some things that I definitely have been looking at Duke. You know, it's obviously tough for them as a school to lose on a season that I think they were coming in as one of the teams that was probably looked at as an upset in the early couple of rounds and played pretty well. But yeah, no, they have a lot of guys who can work really well around Cooper Flagg. And I think that if, you know, another big point in my eyes is that even if Cooper Flagg comes in and doesn't play to the level that we hope he is, he's still going to be a dynamic scorer. He's still going to be one of the top players in the nation. Maybe, you know, maybe he comes in and struggles his first year, but like guys like Proctor, guys like McCann, those are guys that can really help back him up and set up a team. The one thing I will say is that Filipowski is pretty much gone already. His draft stock is too high right now for him to
way too high.
It's too high, but it's too high for him to also not take the opportunity and go to the draft. So right. I know he's gonna go. He'll be like a top 15, top 20 pick. But you know, Cooper Flagg's also at 6'9", if I believe, 6'10". So he still can score inside. So you know, Filipowski is a tough loss for them. It's, again, not guaranteed, but at this point, I'm pretty sure it is.
What's going to be great, too, is all these Duke haters I saw on X all weekend in my group chats are going to have to cheer for the Blue Devils next year for Cooper Flagg to be successful. So that's going to be pretty sweet to see, at least for 1 year.
It is, and I myself, I'm not a big Duke guy, and I'm honestly not even a big college basketball guy, but I'm definitely going to pay a lot more attention to it, and that's what I hope happens in general. I'm just hoping a lot more people pay attention to it, and especially in Maine sports. And, you know, you and I have talked about this before, but we've talked about this even before the podcast started, that we've been waiting and waiting and waiting. Okay, he's clearly the best high school basketball player in the nation. All right, we see it. You know, he won the Naismith Award. He's on the McDonald's team. Like, okay, we're waiting for him to get to college, and now it's finally happening. He's going to go, and he's going to ball out, and people are going to be like, we're really going to start to see that recognition come back. It's like, oh, it's not just high school anymore. This is college. This is the guy who's going to go number one in the draft and go to the NBA, most likely. So it's cool to see. But the one thing that I will say is that when you talk about NC State, I know you think their Cinderella run is going to come to an end, which I think is a pretty fair bet. I do think if any team's going to beat Purdue, it's going to be NC State. The way that they're playing right now, it's just amazing. They're getting scoring all around. You're seeing that Burns obviously is a huge factor on that team, but the game before Duke, who did they play? They played
NC State. They played I don't remember off the top of my head.
He scored 4 points in that game though. And it did not like touch the ball except for defense, right? So that team has other scorers. And I think that you're gonna get an interesting matchup between the 7'4" Zach Edey and the 6'9", 275 and DJ
275, Burns. Yeah, right. Yeah. 275 at 6'9". The guy's at least 310 pounds, which is fine. I mean, but yeah. let's 275, give me a break.
But I do think that it's going to be a good matchup. Should be a good game. I'm going to definitely watch at this point, the Final Four. I think everyone's going to watch. I kind of lost interest in Sweet 16 and Elite Eight, but now I'm excited to watch. But I'll head my one of my rundown topics is pretty kind of related to Purdue, so I'll head into that one. Looking back at the Elite Eight matchup between Purdue and Tennessee, for those who don't know, I'm assuming most people know JP Estrella, former South Portland High School basketball player, is on Tennessee. Throughout the regular season, 4 to 6 minutes, late game when Tennessee was up 15, 20 points. It's what you expect to see from a true freshman. And then got a lot of minutes. And compared to how other players were defending Zach Edey, JP Estrella was like DK Mutombo. Like he was playing such good defense and played a lot of minutes and got some good stats in that line late in that Purdue game. Obviously Tennessee didn't win and Zach Edey ended up with 41. So I can't blame a freshman like JP for, you know, you're not going to shut him down completely. But I guess my question for you is that are these good signs for JP in the future? I know that going into college, looking at a team like Tennessee, they're a good team. They had good players. We assumed he'd probably spend the first couple of years not getting many minutes and then maybe towards his junior, senior year, getting some more playing time. But clearly we're seeing that he's been given opportunities. He's taken the most of them so far. So do you think that JP is somebody that could develop and become a somewhat star or a somewhat notable player in the future? Or is this just one of those really good performances that kind of went unnoticed in the Elite Eight game?
Certainly, there could be good signs. What does it mean for the future? It's tough because this was such a unique matchup, and he was only in there because the guy in front of him had foul trouble. Certainly played great at times. His biggest problem is going to be his offensive game. Like, can he be an offensive threat? Because you notice in that game, and again, they're playing Purdue in the Elite Eight. You know, it's one of the best teams in the country. So he had that one alley-oop dunk, which is pretty cool. But otherwise, on offense, you could see he was by far the fifth option on that offense. His job was to set screens, was to pass. There's nothing wrong with that. But that's kind of – if he wants to get major minutes in SEC going forward, he's going to have to develop that part of his game. You know, you assume he's going to get bigger, you know, bulkier, stronger. Great that Coach Rick Barnes gave him a chance to get in there and get some minutes. So it's not there's no negatives to take from it. It's just, what will this mean for next year? Again, every year there's going to be new guys coming in, new big guys coming in, new freshmen coming in, new transfers. So just because you had a good tournament run or a couple of games in the previous year really doesn't mean much for the next year in terms of playing time, what he does over the offseason. This would be a huge offseason for him. You know, he's been in the program now for a year, you know, in terms of the weight room, in terms of the knowing the campus, knowing the workouts. This is kind of the big summer for him to – you know, take that huge next step and try to get some playing time. I mean, there's no doubt it's pretty cool to see him on CBS out there against one of the best. And I thought he held his own against Edie, who gets every single call. Every time he's touched, he gets the call every time. It's shocking, which is why that's really why I think NC State's in trouble, because DJ is going to get in big foul trouble because Edie can do no wrong in the eyes of the officials. So, but no, it was great to see JP do that. You know, he went to South Portland originally from Scarborough. So it's cool to see such a local guy get some minutes there, especially because during the regular season, like you said, he was a bit player, you know, seventh, eighth, ninth guy off the bench. But when they needed him, he came up with some big stops and also that big dunk. And main Twitter was going crazy. Main high school sports Twitter. I mean, I understand it's exciting. I can only imagine what next year is going to be like with Cooper Flagg, though, because – you know, people are saying, Estrella. I was like, yeah, it's cool. It's cool, but chill. You know, he is just, you know, there's a lot of other states that have guys like him. So, but cool moment. What it mean for the future? It's really up to him this summer. If he can bulk up this summer and become an offensive threat, at least, then you can see him starting on an SEC team that is probably going to be one of the favorites again next year.
Yeah, I had the same point. I definitely agree. I think it's also a big offseason for Tennessee. Now, I might be butchering this name, but there's a guy on Tennessee who averaged like 30 points a game. I think his last name's, it's like spelled like K-N-E-C-H-T. It's like Necht or something. I don't even know.
Yeah.
I don't want to butcher it, but he's, I believe, going to be just out of the system because he's a senior. So the Tennessee in general is also going to have a lot of movement as well. So it's a big time for him to step up. And, you know, it's one of those situations where everyone's rooting for him. Everyone, at least in Maine, is rooting for him. There's nobody here is going, oh, no, we don't want him to play. And everyone's like, yeah, the better he does, the better, you know, the more people think about Maine basketball. And that's really all we want. So it's nice to see. But
it's just crazy, too, because, you know, I know he was a great player in high school. And obviously he went off to prep school for his senior year. Mm-hmm. I saw him twice in person against Thornton Academy, and I didn't come away blown away by him. Now, obviously, his size is unquestionable, and he had some amazing games against other teams. But when I saw him a couple times, I said, like, yeah, he's got some skills and size. But for me, I was like, wow, Tennessee, that's going to be a big leap for him. And he's proved me wrong so far, at least, you know, in that getting some big playing minutes in that big game. So, again, I hope he proves me wrong. I hope he becomes a real superstar there. We all know what Cooper Flagg can do, but for him – you know, while and it's funny because when you see these players in high school, you may only see them in person once, and you get your whole impression around them is sometimes how you see them in that game. So sometimes it can warp you one way or the other.
For sure.
Yeah. So moving on, Maine high school sports, spring has started, the spring season. Everyone's in practices. There's actually some scrimmages here this week as we tape this game. You know, the weather hasn't really cooperated too much. Obviously, not much snow, but we had some snow a couple weeks ago, and now we're going to have a big snow again this week, which may push off baseball, especially for a couple days. Having some discussions with some friends of mine who are in the baseball, more like Little League and things because they have kids. But I've seen a lot of chatter about turf for baseball fields for a couple reasons. One, just because of, you know, the spring can be wet and you can't really practice or play games when it's super wet, even if there's no snow. And secondly, for the versatility of it, meaning you could have two or three baseball diamonds on one large field. So where do I stand on that? I'm against it. I understand, you know, I'm a purist when it comes to sports like that. I understand why basically every high school has gone to turf for football. Because you have football, lacrosse, soccer, tons of stuff in track and field, even that are on those, and field hockey on those fields. It just didn't make much sense anymore to have that. I understand the injury part of it. That's a whole nother discussion. When it comes to baseball, I mean, I'm just such a purist. Like, baseball is all about tradition, and to have, you know, not even like just, oh, we're going to have a dirt infield, but we're going to have turf as the grass. But like, no, these are like turf fields all the way through. Now, UNE has this situation where they have a softball field that basically shares a big space with a football field. What they have to do is they have to put up a temporary fence for games. Certainly when there's a softball or baseball game going on there or practice, they can't have anything going on in the big field. At a place like UNE, they have multiple fields on a large campus so they can practice somewhere else. But for high schools, it really wouldn't make much sense. And there's also the argument, well, if you have these turf fields with like Little League or softball on three corners, and you could rent it out. But again, at what cost? And not only just the upfront cost of putting in a turf field, but it's just it's a different game. Like, the way the ball bounces on the grass and on the dirt, it's very different than what you'd see on turf. So, you know, I think there's a lot of, I'm seeing a lot more often opinions, people coming up and saying, hey, you should think about turf field for baseball. I don't think it's going to happen anytime soon, and I don't support it just because I understand the problems that they're having now where they have to practice inside or on pavement or something. Like, I get that. But at some point, you know, you got to play on regular stuff. You can't just play on turf everywhere. It's just not practical. And obviously you have the maintenance too of that too, where we're about to replace our turf field, you know, here at Thornton Academy. It's been about 10 or 11 years. And that's the life of these things. And they cost upwards of $1 million to replace. So, but yeah, I'm curious your thoughts on that. If you're a baseball purist and honestly, you played soccer a lot at younger ages, and how did you like playing on turf for that?
Well, soccer, I think turf is better. I know, like, the funny thing is that a lot of, I think the situation in high school versus the pros is a lot different. You see the pros, it's like grass, and everything in soccer, in football, in everything that you can find. Whereas in high school, I think turf is looked at as the better product. At least the eyes that I got, I always thought turf was better for soccer. But my sort of where the way I come into this argument is that, or this conversation, I should say, is Quinnipiac this year. They're 100% new turf field. It is super nice. It looks really nice. And I was there. I got to call the first game ever on that turf. And the game to me wasn't a lot different, which I think is a big thing, is people like, oh, the game's going to change. It's going to be faster, you know, because the turf and whatever. Not a big difference to me. I didn't hear or see anybody complaining about it. I haven't heard of any complaints from fans or from players. I think it, at the end of the day, it comes down to money. Money is a big factor. It's a big factor for high schools where, you know, you can get turf fields put in colleges like this, because you've got, especially at huge schools, because you've got hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars coming in from donors, not even the school has to pay for it, like all donor based. Whereas high school is a little bit different. The high school has to, you know, it's a bigger chunk of the budget. I think TA finds themselves in a situation here where if the football field provides more, you know, when they look ahead to, okay, what's going to help us in the long run? What's going to bring in the most money in the long run? Let's do the football field. That's the turf that soccer, lacrosse, field hockey, football. I'm trying to think, is there any other sports to play on the turf?
Lacrosse, field hockey, football, and soccer.
Soccer. And then the track, obviously, but they're not redoing the track. But it'll be interesting to see what the change is the next 5 to 10 years in general in high schools. It's the timing's not great right now for TA specifically.
No, and I think the other part of it too is at colleges, it makes sense, a little bit more sense to do the baseball fields because you are going to practice year-round, basically, or almost year-round, especially even in the Northeast, and you're going to play a lot of games. In high school, the season's not going to extend. And yeah, you could rent it out to little leagues and other things, but that's not the reason to spend $1 million on a turf field. So like, that's why at high school level, I don't understand it, because the season's still only going to be 2.5-3 months long at most. And for me, I kind of get a little cynical because I'm like, all right, if you're going to turf the baseball field, don't even paint, you know, or have a section that looks like supposed to be dirt. You know, if you're gonna do a if you're gonna do a turf baseball field, make it all green except for the line, you know, the lines and maybe a little thing around the base. But it's like we're trying to like trick people that there's because some of these schools that have that they'll have like the turf will be like the tan like look make it look like dirt. It's like you're not fooling anybody. It's still turf. So that's for me. It's like all right, if you're gonna do it, don't pretend like you're trying to make it look like a baseball field because you're not. It's not a baseball field. It's a turf field that just has different lines on it. And that's I guess where the purist comes in. Even for football fields, it's like you're just so basically you're just building this huge square of turf. And you're just drawing specific lines on there. It really could be anything. That could be any type of field. There's nothing special about it. It's just turf with different lines that you've cut out, you know, versus an actual baseball field, which with a you know permanent fence and dirt and chalk and you know I don't know. It's just for me, baseball's all about tradition. So we'll see how it goes. I'm not saying they're going to do that anytime around here, but you're hearing more of that now that these you know especially in a spring like this where. The baseball team has a game today, and yet they know they're going to be out of there for about a week because of the storm coming up.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I'm going to head into a topic that hits home for me. You may know where I'm headed with this. The Quinnipiac men's ice hockey team in the NCAA regional round in Providence lost in overtime 5-4 to the Boston College Eagles, who I'm going to say this first off, and I say not because I'm I'm pessimistic, not because I don't love my school, because I love my school. I'm a Bobcat for life. We should have never, that game should have never been that close. BC played horrible hockey, and we played good hockey until overtime. And I think looking at the game, I was proud of how they played. They missed some opportunities in regulation. I think in overtime, the first play, there was a couple plays in OT where it looked like Duplessis was making some saves and looking a little bit rusty. Like, you know, he was starting to, you know, fall off as you know, playing more than 60 minutes was starting to get too much. But the last goal, the overtime goal, it's an unfortunate mistake. He thinks he's got the puck covered. He doesn't have it covered at all. And then the defenseman goes to grab the puck, and the defenseman's first thought should be smack that puck. Even if you take a penalty, smack that puck out. And instead, he tried to like play it out, gave it right up in a goal. That stuff happens. Like I know people, I've heard people say, "Oh my God, oh it's all Vinny's fault. It's all the defense." I think it was Davis Pennington was the defender. "Oh, it's all Davis's fault. It's horrible." Like that happens. It happens. You know, imagine playing in a regional final in overtime against the best team in college hockey. You'd be nervous, and you're not always going to make the best decision at the right moment at the right time. So I don't blame them for that. But overall, I think it's a disappointing loss. This is looking ahead. The team is not going to be as good. That basically the top five players are gone, and goaltending is not. I mean, Mateus Marjanov is a good freshman goalie, but. It's not. I don't know if he's ready to play a full season, but it is what it is. You know, it's I'd never thought they'd go back to back. I was if they had beaten BC, I would have been like, okay, like this is possible. But to me, it all started with the ECAC semifinal loss because if they had won the semifinal game. Even if they had lost the final, but let's just say they had won the final. They had won the ECAC because they blew out the regular season. Let's say they won it. They would have had a better seeding. They probably would have ended up in – I'm pretty sure they would have ended up in the bracket with Michigan and North Dakota and – or Michigan State and North Dakota. And I think that was a much more doable bracket for them than BC. I think they would have made the Frozen Four, and it would have been another – you know, wildly successful season for them. Just didn't work out that way. But, you know, not every team's gonna win. Looking at the rest of the NCAA, I'm pretty happy where it's at. I think Michigan was an underrated team, and they showed it in the game against Michigan State. I think BC got a little bit lucky that we made some mistakes, but I think BC is still the best team in the country. I think BU showed out against Minnesota, and I'm glad that they did. And Denver is the most fraudulent team out of those four. And I think that BU has a cakewalk. Now that I say this, BU has a cakewalk to the final. If they don't make the final, BU is it's because BU choked, because Denver is struggling right now to score. And BU just can shut that down in 5 minutes in the first period and win that game. So I'm hoping for BC, BU national championship. That is a great storyline for college hockey. It's a great storyline for BU because they got smoked in the regular season by BC. And it comes down to how awesome hockey is in New England, because that's how awesome hockey is. But I want to get your thoughts. Don't go too hard on Quinnipiac. We don't want to get into some arguments here, but just tell me a little bit about what you thought about the game. I know you watched a little bit of it, and then tell me about your Frozen Four thoughts of one of the teams that are in it.
My only comment about Quinnipiac is, you know what you did. You choked. You choked, you choked, you choked the whole game. They couldn't stay out of the penalty box, which, you know, the number one rule against Boston College is stay out of the penalty box. BU learned that the hard way. They scored, give up 4 power play goals in the Hockey East Championship. And I'm not saying that every call was legit. I thought the refs weren't great in that game, but Quinnipiac continued to do it. They were in the let's fast forward to third period. It's back forth game. The wide open net that was missed that would have made the game 5-3 with about 9 minutes to go. I don't think BC's coming back from that. And then, of course, they were doing a great job. Quinnipiac was, for about half the period, just killing the clock, not letting anything go. And then a horrific turnover led to the tying goal. And then in overtime, obviously, I knew what was going to happen there. And as you said, it was a bad clearance. So when I say choked, I don't care. I don't count the overtime. Overtime's anything can happen. And look, if they don't make that bad turnover, it's 7.5 minutes ago was when BC tied it. I'm not saying that it's not a possibility that BC would have tied the game. It's just so many small little things that they could have done differently. And for any team playing Boston College, if, you know, playing them 5-on-5, they beat BC, like, easily, right? It was the staying out of the penalty box. They couldn't do it. Teams continue to commit penalties against them. And that's why, you know, and BC's great. Look, but when you see someone like Fowler, who's a goalie for BC, has had a fantastic year. He's given up the 4 goals, you know, against Quinnipiac. You're like, all right, this is your chance to get him. But you just couldn't stop. And BC, I mean, they've now scored 5 goals in like 13 of the last 16 games or something crazy like that in a row in the crunch time. So I'm jesting a little bit about Quinnipiac choking. I do feel bad for them because, as I saw in the last couple of days, like the transfer portal, like you said, your whole team is just basically decimated. Yeah. And I was looking at some of the Quinnipiac, because it's still showing up on my feed, the Quinnipiac like Barstool account, and they're just like, you know, we had to, you know, this is just the end of an era. Like, we had to enjoy it. They all came back for one last ride. It didn't work out, and now they're going to move on. But of course, I get really pissed watching that game because I don't want BC to win. I don't want a BU-BC championship because I can't take that, because I think BC is one of the best teams in the history of college hockey, and they were right there. That open net, that's the one that really gets me. You get that? Okay. You're up by 2 goals. Game over.
So I'm going to give you a little – I'm going to cut you some slack, because clearly I'm seeing here that a part of the reason why you're a little bit frustrated at Quinnipiac missing that opportunity was because you wanted BC to lose.
Of course. If they were playing North Dakota, I wouldn't have cared.
But I think – I don't think I can ever call it a choke. I will never, ever look at it as a choke, because they were 100% an underdog going in. Every team misses opportunities. Those were missed opportunities.
That's a goal that I could have scored on skates, and I don't skate. You give me that 10 times, I'm scoring that 7 or 8 times, and
it was a wild game throughout. It was 100% a wild game throughout. And as you mentioned, you know, it's you're looking ahead, it does feel like the last ride. I don't think it's that much of a like, it's not like they're not going to be good. Like, I was talking about this with somebody today, like, I still think they'll be the best team in the ECAC next year, if not one of the top 3 teams. And you know, obviously guys like Jacob Quillen or Colin Graf is going to sign somewhere. A couple of our captain, Jaden Lee, is gone, or I think is going to go. I'm not, you know, again, none of these things. The only thing I know is definite is Quillen just signed with the Maple Leafs.
There's a couple guys who were like a package deal, they were saying online. Yeah.
And then a couple of guys, Filion and Christophe Tellier, are both in the transfer portal as well. Both, you know,
but they could come back. You never know. Some guys go in the transfer portal, look around, and realize that they're, you know,
for sure,
they can't come back.
But you know, you look ahead, and hopefully they're good next year. It's a tough loss.
It is. For the Frozen Four, look, I don't discount Denver as much as you and other people. A lot of people said that they stink, but, like, you know, they're not. I'm not taking them for granted. I see another. BU's defense hasn't played that well. They give up a lot of goals. I think they won 6-3 in both of their regional games. Obviously, you know, we will touch on UMaine here. They lost to Cornell in that first round, disappointing, and then Cornell lost to Denver. But Denver did have a struggle with UMass. They almost lost to the four seed. They had to go to, they had to win in the overtime. So,
and the funniest thing to me is everyone after that game is going, "Oh, I knew UMass was great." No, UMass is an okay team. Denver,
yeah, they shouldn't have made it.
And Denver did not play well in that game. The thing to me is that, like, and you just mentioned those. Maine lost because they are very, very young and they just don't have that experience. In the future, they will, and they would win a matchup like that any day of the week. Denver beat Cornell because Cornell did not play their best hockey, and Denver again got lucky and had to win in overtime. And they're struggling to score, and that's the one thing that hurts BU. So I know that you're gonna, you know, as a BU fan, you gotta be, oh, it's gonna be a great game. 5-1 easily. Macklin Celebrini scores a bunch of, like, you're going to run through to the national championship. I don't think I've been more confident in something in my life. Denver is struggling so hard to score, and BU right now is on their game. You're right. Yes, they gave up 3 goals to RIT. Yes, they gave up 3 to Minnesota, but they scored 6 in both games, and they took it away at the end of the game. So I see them
winning 4-2 with an empty net goal. I think they're going to win. Look, I think it's going to be BCBU in the championship, and I think BC smokes us like they did before. I just think BC is a team of destiny, and when a team wins a game like they did against Quinnipiac, where they weren't playing that well and they still somehow found a way to win, as much as I want to say Quinnipiac choke, it was also BC never giving up, and they just have so much skill that I just think it's going to be BC. I watched one of the games in person where BC beat BU, and then obviously I watched the hockey's final, which made me frustrated. So I just... Yeah. This BC's on a heater, and I hate to say it, but, like, they're just so freaking talented. It's so annoying. I hate BC.
The one thing I'll say before we head into your last topic is I am so glad Ryan Leonard did not get that last goal to finish the hat trick, because then on X, you would have seen the, oh, Ryan Leonard masterclass game. That last goal was an easy tap. Lucky,
for
the defender who tapped it, I don't even know his name. I'll be honest. I don't even know who he is. But people would have been like, oh, he scored a hat trick. He's amazing. Masterclass game. He's the reason they won. No, we made a huge mistake. It sucks, but it happens. And that defender got a tap-in goal to win them the region. And I'm just so glad Ryan Leonard didn't get it, because that would have made me so mad, so mad.
Now he'll get one against Michigan. I think they smoke Michigan. I think Michigan's been a good team, but, like, Michigan State was the team that could have beat BC, but didn't do it. All right, my third and final rundown take is talking about the Patriots draft, which is, about a month away, less than a month away. My big point is there anybody going to, like, what is the pick that is going to make the most people happy? Because no matter what they do, there's going to be a large part of the people upset, whether they trade the pick, whether they take Marvin Harrison Jr., whether they take Jaden Daniels, whether they take J.J. McCarthy, whether they take Drake May, right? Those are really the options we're looking at right now. My opinion, of course, is to take Marvin Harrison Jr. Just because he's more likely to be a superstar than any of the quarterbacks that they pick. And again, this is just me sitting here not knowing much.
I agree.
But you've seen, and look, the stories are all over the place. Someone's saying J.J. McCarthy's going to go number 2. I've seen, that the Patriots are enamored with Jaden Daniels. I've seen other stories that say Drake May, if they fall to us, may be the rawest, but he may have the biggest upside. But a lot of people are going to be pissed no matter what. So it's going to be interesting on draft night, because I may be sitting with 3 people watching it, my buddies, and all 4 of us have a different opinion. So we're like, I think if they draft Marvin Harrison, the only one would get me like a fist bump. If they took a quarterback, I'm not going to scream bloody murder and be like, oh no, but I'm just going to be like, okay. Yeah, okay. You think Jaden Daniels better be Patrick Mahomes because you had a chance to get? Because here you play it out, right? And everyone says, "Well, you got to take a quarterback. You got to take a quarterback. You got to take a quarterback." All right, so let's play it out. You take a quarterback. Where and how are you going to get a number one wide receiver? Right? How is that going to happen? Because let's just say you draft a quarterback number 3. He's probably not going to start. You're probably going to go 5-12, 6-11 this year, right? Maybe, probably 5. Let's say it's 5-11 or 5-12. So you're going to be picking number 8 or 9 in the draft. Could you get a wide receiver there? Maybe, right? You're never going to have a number 3 pick again. As much as I'm pessimistic about the team, I don't see. Plus, I see a lot of other teams going really bad next year. So you can't, and they're so incredibly hard to trade the quarterbacks are a lot easier to trade for than the stud wide receivers, because they all just sign mega deals at their own clubs. So I think I'm not saying it's perfect. And then you say, well, what do you do at quarterback? I'm like, I don't know. I mean, you can draft one in the second round and try to develop one of them. You have Jacoby Brissett. Maybe you try to swing a trade with somebody. I don't say I have the answers, but just saying, I mean, you draft a quarterback and then what? You're still running with a subpar wide receiver and weapons group. And I was talking to this today, like, let's say you get super lucky and you get Josh Allen, the next Josh Allen. What has he really done? Now, is he a good quarterback? Yes. Is he a great quarterback? Some days. And he even has one great wide receiver, but without the weapons around him, he hasn't gone to the Super Bowl. Brock Purdy has a lot fewer skills than any of the top quarterbacks, we would say, but does have the weapons around him and has gone to some Super Bowls. Now, he hasn't won any, but he's getting that chance. So, again, you need weapons around you. And unless you think that who they're drafting and who they're developing are going to be stud wide receivers and tight ends, the quarterback is such a can't miss. It's just such a big risk. Whereas you get Marvin Harrison Jr., very, very, very few wide receivers at the very top of the draft end up being busts. So I think it's the path of least resistance. I don't think they're going to go that way. I think they're going to go quarterback because Gerard Mayo and Elliott Wolf, they want to pick their guy, their quarterback. Because, you know, the problem too in the NFL is now they're going to have 2 to 3 years to do this thing right. And if they don't do it right, they're going to be gone. So that's my thoughts. But again, my overall point is, after draft night, so many of us are still going to be like, okay, hope you made the right choice, right? There's not going to be any like, yes, we got him, right? So I don't know. What are your thoughts on not so much what the Patriots should do, but like, what is your reaction going to be from fans?
Yeah, well, I'll take it back a step first. I think that I like what Gerard Mayo's done so far. Or, I mean, I know he's not the GM, but I think he's got to have some say in that. Getting rid of Mac Jones, some very simple moves in free agency. I like the Brissett move. I like the KJ Osborne move as a wide receiver 2, wide receiver 3. I think Douglas is also going to be big in that wide receiving core. I think that they are in a prime opportunity right now to do this, to draft Harrison, because I think that that's the majority of happiness. I'd say 40% of fans would be like, heck awesome. Awesome. And the other 60 are not going to be, they might be a little bit like, oh, we needed a quarterback, but they're not going to be like, oh, this wide receiver sucks, because he doesn't. He's insane. But, and then you spend a year. I agree. Even with, let's just say they take Harrison, they're like 5-12, 4-11, or what? I don't even know the number. It's 17 weeks now, right? 17 games.
Yeah.
So whatever.
Yeah, it's 5-12. But,
Yeah, their middle of the round pick, that's not great for a QB. And this is where, if they did the draft picks like the NHL, where it's all lottery based, that would help the Patriots, because it's all like, oh, you know, we could get number one. But you develop Harrison with Brissett. He's a veteran quarterback. He's been in the league a while. He's going to get him targets. He's going to give him a year of development. And you go for a quarterback in the future. That's what I think they should do. I think that they are going to make the worst possible choice in terms of what the fans want. It's going to be McCarthy or Drake May. Because in my eyes, the best quarterback on that board, other than Caleb Williams, is Jaden Daniels. And I think that's 100%, in my opinion, the truth. It goes Williams, Daniels, McCarthy, May, in terms of who is going to with the best upside. And I think that they're just going to go McCarthy or May, because Gerard Mayo sees something and he knows that it's going to be great. And oh, KJ Osborne's a possible wide receiver 1 upside. That's just not happening. But that's what we're so used to as Patriots fans. I mean, I'm not a long term Patriots fan. I'm new. I don't know if we've been over this, but I've come back into the
this is going to be now that you stop cheering for the Falcons, they're going to end up going to the Super Bowl this year because they got Kirk Cousins.
But the one thing I will say is, Patriots fans, be glad you don't have Bill Belichick, because if Belichick was still here, he would have taken some old linemen.
Joe Alt from Notre Dame, at
pick 3, and he would have said, oh, this guy's going to be the next old lineman. He's going to be great. And it would have been another Cole Strange, just another one of those, like, why did you do that? So be glad we don't have Bill Belichick. But I think at the end of the day, also, I don't think Gerard Mayo gives one single crap about what any fan thinks. He is going to do what he thinks is best for the organization, and that's it. Or whoever the GM. What's the situation like?
Elliott Wolf is the kind of the temporary GM, but he hasn't had the official title yet. This is kind of like a test year for him, I guess.
All right. Yeah. So Mayo and Wolf combined, I think, are going to do what they think is best for the organization. Whether or not the fans like it, that's to be seen. But It's always good to look back in the past. How many times have we seen some of the best players in the NFL, when they get drafted, you see the fan reactions from home going, God, sell the franchise, this, you know, fire the GM, it's the worst pick ever. And then 2 years later, those same people are like, oh my God, I love this guy, I'm so glad we drafted him. I knew he was going to be great on draft night. Like, so a lot of times fans overreact at stuff that they really don't understand, or they don't, because we're never going to understand why they picked who they pick. It's interesting, though. The most excited I think I've ever been to watch a Patriots take a pick, because there's no guarantee on who it's going to be in my eyes. Right. It's still up in the air.
You got to stay off Twitter or X to make sure you don't get it ruined. I'm going to be like, no one text. I'm turning off my phone for like that 10 minutes, you know, just to. But again, once they take, let's say they take one of those guys, like I don't want Daniels and I don't want McCarthy, but if they take him, of course, for that 5 minutes when the show is highlights, they show him with the Patriots hat on and be like, all right, he's our guy. But then, you know, then reality will set in. But we'll see. We'll see. A couple more weeks finally. I'm just ready for it to be over with and move on. Mm-hmm.
So my last rundown topic is very quick, because I am just making one big bold statement. I'll get your thoughts on it, but I'm making a bold statement. This Red Sox team is going to surprise a lot of people. I'm not going to count the Athletics game from last night, because the Athletics played horrible. They're the worst, pretty much the worst MLB franchise. A 9-0 win against them doesn't mean anything more than, okay, you beat the Athletics. Like, that's not much. They split the series with the Mariners. We got great pitching from some of our guys that were question marks. We have Tyler O'Neill, probably one of the best free agent pickups right now with how he's been playing. And I don't know if you know this, but he has hit a home run on opening day for 5 straight seasons. They are looking like one of those teams that no one has their eye on, that can score runs, that can settle down into games, and can play very, very long, can play the long game, where in the past, I don't think that's been the situation. I think in the Seattle series, they scored a lot of runs in some games, and other games they kept it really close, really late. And something I think the Red Sox really struggled with is you're looking at innings 4 through 7 as giving up, you know, holding 1 through 3 solid, then 4 through 7, they give up like 6 runs and they lose a game because they can't come back. Just mark my words, halfway through the season, the Red Sox are still going to be a wild card contender. Not that I think they're probably going to make the playoffs, but they're still going to be a wild card contender, and people are going to be like, oh, okay, let's watch the Red Sox the rest of the season. So I don't know what your thoughts are, but I was very happy to split the series with the Mariners. I really thought we were going to go 0-4 to start.
I would just say chill. I don't think they're going to be, you know, the bottom's not going to fall out. They're not going to win 50 games or something like that. But they played the Mariners, who didn't make the playoffs last year. Mm-hmm. And they're playing Athletics now, who are basically a Triple-A team.
Yep.
Let's just chill. I agree that their performances were great off, you know, their pitching. I don't potentially see that happening the rest of the season. I think their lineup's going to be fine this year. Look, where do I put them? I mean, I put them at like 75 and 85 for the year. You know, like maybe 80 and 82, like right around 500. Look, and the thing too, what you mentioned, like going to be in wild card contention, the way the stupid rules are nowadays, like pretty much everyone's in wild card contention, you know, because there's 3 wild card spots. So, and look, the MLB does that to make the season interesting, especially the trading deadline. Mm-hmm. I know there's nothing much else to talk about in April in terms of, you know, the Celtics are cruising, the Bruins are cruising, they're just waiting for the playoffs, the Patriots are off season. So that first week, but again, you never know. I mean, was it a couple of years ago, the Sox went 0-3 against the Orioles, and everybody thought they were going to suck, and then they made a deep run into the playoffs, what, 3 years ago. So it's hard to tell. Baseball is so tough to tell in the first few days, though you can tell, like, teams like the A's are going to be – I mean, they had 5 errors in the first 3 innings on Monday night.
Yeah.
I mean, just pathetic. They have – their whole payroll is, like, $47 million. They're, like, a couple players who are making more than them. It's and they have, like, nobody at their games. It's a pathetic franchise right now. You should win those games. You have to win all those games.
Yeah, of course. I don't know if you saw this. Not only one, but 2 players have been either sent down or benched, 2 very good prospects that are deserving of MLB time that have that ability because they were wearing a bracelet or in some way promoting the fan strike. And the ownership said, nope, you're not playing for us. And I understand why they did that to some degree, but those are your 2 best prospects that you need to be playing MLB minutes, and you sent them down to make what, a statement? All right, make your statement, let them back up. But just they need to that franchise needs some sort of revamping. I don't know how, I don't know when, but it needed soon because it's just tough for them. Mm-hmm. But that'll do it for the rundown segment for this week, and we're going to head straight into our interview. Been very excited about this one. Jeff and I have been working to make sure we get this one in the first couple of weeks, and it is going to be Dave Eade. So we want to welcome in.
All right, we're now joined by our special guest for this week. It's the sports director of WGME 13 here in Portland, Maine. It's Dave Eade. Dave, how are you doing today?
Guys, so great to be with you. Doing well. Could do without the impending snow, but spring is in the air.
Absolutely. So we'll get right into it here. So you, you know, we've known each other for quite a while. I worked on the Maine Rundown way back in the day for WPXT. Obviously been at Thornton Academy for a long time, seen you on the sidelines. I want to jump right into it because I remember having this conversation with you maybe 10 years ago. And when I was going through college at Boston University and wanted to be a sports, you know, sports anchor, sports whatever, they said, look, you're going to start off in market number 200, and then you're going to go to market 125. So you're going to start out in small town Wyoming, then you go to Corpus Christi, Texas, then you're going to go to 75, Portland, Maine, then you're going to go to Providence, then you go to Boston if you're good. And I asked you once, like, Dave, you've been here a long time in Portland. You're obviously very skilled. Everyone, you know, loves what you do. Why haven't you made that next move to Providence and Boston? And you just said, This is my dream. Like, this is why I love it here. So I want you to talk about that. I can't remember how many years you've been in Portland, but you're a guy who could have moved on but chose to stay. So what is it about Portland, Maine that made you want to stay all these years?
Well, I grew up not too far south in Massachusetts. And when I got to Maine, I got to Bangor originally. I started in Wisconsin, northern Wisconsin. That is a whole, I mean, how I started in the business was crazy because I went to graduate school at Marquette, made some contacts there, and then went back to Massachusetts. I took a job in radio, AM radio, early morning, you know, morning news. And I just wasn't really happy, to be honest. I always wanted television. And so one of my friends from Marquette was working in Rhinelander, Wisconsin. And he said, you know, come on out here. You can intern. You know, he was the sports director out there. So I packed up my little Toyota, went out to Rhinelander. I remember working at the Holiday Inn as a banquet waiter for 35 hours. And I interned at this TV station. It was so small, guys. I mean, it was a really teeny station. And I was doing, you know, double duty to pay the rent and then to learn the craft, you know, which was television. So eventually, about 4 or 5 months into my internship, one of the reporters left for Wausau. They ended up hiring me as a news reporter. And then my friend Al ultimately left for a radio job in Wausau. And I became the sports director from there. I went to Bangor and then down to Portland. But to get back to your original question, I love Maine. I feel this is home for me. My kids were born here. My wife was from here. And I even if someday I did leave the business for whatever reason, I'll never leave Maine. Maine is home. I love the people like yourselves. The most unbelievable thing now, guys, is I'll be at an event, most recently the high school basketball tournament this past winter. And I had a young man come up to me at the expo and said, you don't remember me, but you covered me when I was in high school. And he had two little kids, you know, that he you know, his sons. And it was just the neatest thing that, you know, that he remembered. And I'd been in the market for so long. So I still love it. I still love what I do. But most of all, I love the people of Maine.
But things have changed a lot since you've been here. And I want to talk about just kind of the state of local stations. And obviously, on the news side, you've seen a lot of stations cut back on personnel and sports. Yeah. So look, in the Portland market, you used to have two people. You know, it was you and somebody else in your department. Channel 8 used to have two people. Channel 6, News Center Maine, doesn't really even do sports anymore. They don't have a dedicated sports person, which for me, we all love high school sports in this chat here. It's shocking to me because I feel like high school sports and sports in general are still something that people, and we talk with Michael Hoffer, same thing, of the forecaster. People love high school sports. They always want to see their kids. Where do you think, what do you see sports coverage for local media stations in 10 years. Are there sports in any, and again, a place like you and Travis Lee, you guys have been staples in this market for a long time. Whenever you decide to retire and move on, it makes me nervous about who's going to take that void and fill that with these local stations. So what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, hopefully they find a value in sports. I think somewhere along the way, stations started to downsize. And where's the first area you cut? Like, for example, when they run out of time in the newscast, the first area they cut is sports, because I'm usually towards the end of the show. So it's easy to, you know, to cut from there. So it's definitely alarming, guys. And I don't know where it goes from here. I'm kind of glad that I'm on the back nine of my career, because I'm not really sure 10 years from now what sports is going to look like at 6 o'clock or 11 o'clock. It's constantly changing, and not for the better as far as local sports go. You mentioned Travis. I know he's got Joe Bailey that helps him out shooting and editing and producing. And Channel 6 does cover like the big events. They were at the Maine hockey game. Sam Rogers does a great job when given the opportunity to mm-hmm. do sports. So, but it's dwindling. It really is. And I know our place here, it's just me for the most part. But even for big events, they will give me a little bit of help. Again, go back to the Maine game in Springfield. But it's definitely different than it was when I first broke into the business. I can recall a time when there were four people in the sports office here at GME. We had a full-time producer, and we had three, you know, on-air people that went out and did, you know, stories and that sort of thing. So it's definitely changed quite a bit. So it's funny, the older I get, the more I'm doing. So I don't know.
That's right. Should be the opposite. You should be on the back nine like Bruce Glazier was for a while. Like, come on.
I know. Yeah. So we'll see. You know, as long as I'm able, I'm going to keep doing it. And really, the thing that keeps me going are the local teams, and especially the high school student athletes. I absolutely love, you know, being at Hill Stadium or you know, Deering High School. I love covering the kids. That's really what it's all about. And that's the one thing that you can't get on ESPN or NESN mm-hmm. or, you know, or NBC Sports Boston. Yeah, you can get the Red Sox and everything else, but you can't get those personal human interest stories from right in our own backyard.
For sure. So obviously we just talked about how in some areas it is, you know, decreasing a little bit, but also we're in a time right now where so many teenagers and young adults like myself want to get into the sports media field. So as somebody who's worked in sports for so long, what is some advice you give to someone like me or anybody out there who's interested in sports media, but maybe doesn't know how to get into it or doesn't know which field is right for them?
Well, I would say, Zach, the most important thing is to have many tools in your toolbox. And by that, I mean, be able to go out and cover a blizzard. And yes, you can cover the Sea Dogs opener and you can cover I'm anchoring the news Sunday night. They ran out of anchors. So I was, you know, and I volunteered. I don't mind. But there is, you know, some, you know, importance to that, and that you want to be valuable and that you can do different things instead of just boxing yourself into the sports corner. Mm-hmm. So I would say, you know, have many tools. And I always thought the most important thing is to intern as much as you can, mm-hmm. kind of see how it's done on the day-to-day basis, what goes into it, putting a show together, putting a story together. I think that's important. But the industry is changing in that, for example, like podcasts now are becoming really huge. And I know our station is starting to do podcasts little by little. So, you know, be adaptable, you know, get ready to change, but keep the drive. And I think that's the other important thing. You know, if you show a station or a news director or general manager that you have that fifth gear, that you have that drive, you're going to find a job somewhere. And some station is going to be lucky to have you.
You mentioned before the fact that you're at the end of the newscast usually. So sometimes they say, hey, we got something breaking. So instead of 5 minutes, you have 3 minutes. When you're figuring out your week, your day, talk about equity a little bit. Like you have, there are on a given day, 50 different sporting events going on in your coverage area. How do you choose what to do? It's obvious when it's state tournament time, but I'm talking like on a random day, Friday night lights, or in the winter or in the spring, you're trying to be equitable, but also you want to have eyeballs on the news. So how do you schedule that out? Like, what is that on a day-to-day basis, figuring out where you go?
Well, I just think of, you know, a lot of it has to do with like the importance of the story. Is it a human interest story? Is it a slow time of year where you can roll out a 2-minute piece on a young student athlete who's doing other things besides, you know, scoring goals on the ice, maybe volunteering his or her time to help the community out. I love doing human interest stories. They take up some time. You not only have to shoot them, but you have to really craft them, edit them the right way. The video and the interviews, it all has to tie together. So each day is different. You know, I woke up this morning and heard of the unfortunate passing of Larry Lucchino. Well, Larry Lucchino, I spent some time with not only here in Maine, but down in Florida when we used to cover spring training. So I found some stuff that we had done in the past and puts, you know, a nice little thing together. So it all depends on the day. The Maine Celtics are in the playoffs. They're home Thursday night. So we were at practice today gathering some sound. But there are those times when it's really, really, really dead. It's just that dead zone when there's nothing going on. We had, you know, the University of Maine women's basketball team win the America East, advanced to the NCAAs, and of course the hockey team made it to the NCAAs as well. So we had those to kind of keep it going. And now with the Red Sox, will be their home opener next week. Sea Dogs, I don't think they'll play Friday, which is their scheduled home opener. But, you know, we may still be at Hadlock Field if there's a lot of snow out there for Friday night. You know, just kind of as an off, you know, kind of a funny home opener that, you know, building snowmen instead of, you know, playing baseball. So definitely, it all depends on the day, Jeff, but you always put in your mind, you know, the viewer at home, what do they want to see? And you want to keep it as local as possible. And then if you have time after, you build out with, you know, Patriots and Red Sox and that sort of thing.
For sure. So you talked earlier about having that, you know, enjoying that connection with local sports and with local athletes. And so talk a little about these interviews that you do on some Friday nights with these athletes. How do these connections help kind of grow not only that recognition of local sports and local athletes, but also your connection with it as well?
I've been to some of these before, these late night, Friday night, the football game or basketball game. I love it. The kids love it, but it's live TV. We are not doing that to tape.
Yeah, it is. And Hill Stadium on a Friday night is because, you know, you don't have a lot of Friday night games
right
there. But when you do and that talcum powder goes everywhere, you know, in the stands, it's pretty neat. But, I'll tell you a story why the kids are so important. I had a couple quick stories for you. I had open heart surgery in 2019. I had a valve replacement, a mitral valve. And it was 6 weeks before I could even think about going back to work. But I wanted to hit that 6-week marker because the spring state championships were that weekend. So I got the okay from my doctor. He said, you can't carry the camera, even though I did. And I was down at Fitzpatrick Stadium, and St. Dom's was playing in the lacrosse championships. What happened was they had a lot of kids go to Rome for spring break, or not for spring break, but that week of the state tournaments. They didn't think they were going to be playing, and they were really short. They had just enough players to compete for a state championship. So a young lady by the name of Avery Lutrakowski, she ended up scoring like 7 or 8 goals in that game. And I remember setting up the camera to do an interview after the game, after the awards. And I said to her, boy, oh boy, you had quite a great game. Talk about, you know, scoring all those goals and not even having a break because there was no reserves. And the first thing she said to me was, more importantly, how are you feeling? And it really struck me that, you know, there's a young kid, 17, 18 years old, just wins a state championship, shorthanded, phenomenal story. And she was concerned about, I didn't even know she knew that I had went and had surgery, open heart surgery. So that's why it's so important to me, because these kids are really, they're in tune, they're dialed in, they do care, and we care about them. I can speak for Travis as well. He loves being out there. Michael Hoffer, Steve Craig, you know, all those guys, Travis Lasargic, they love being with the kids, covering them, and it's just a great, it's a great thing that we're able to provide for them. And I know when they get on TV, I notice when they're running into the end zone, if they're running by my camera, they always have a special wave or something. So that's really neat. And Zach, I kind of went all the way around, but that's why it's important to me. These kids are, they're special. They're from Maine, and they're just, they're amazing, amazing student athletes.
Awesome. Well, one more question before we kind of move on to the book, your new book. I want to, you mentioned some of the other people, and I have two in the market, whether it's guys that are in the news stations or some of the newspapers or even some other avenues now, podcasts or you know, Big Time Hoops Maine, places like that. You know, obviously you all are very friendly with each other. I've seen it on the sidelines. We're all helping each other. It is a business. So how did, you know, I worked in TV, ratings are still king. So in the sports specifically, how, talk about the competition. Like, they're nice guys, but also in the end, how do you try to be like, we're all friends, but also I, you know, ratings do matter. And do they matter to a sports person? Or is that really the news director that's really kind of pushing that 6 o'clock, who's watching us at 6:05 versus the sports stuff?
Well, I mean, I'd be a liar if I said, we don't want to be number one. You know, we don't care right about being number one. You want to be number one. You really do. But at what cost? So I am always true to myself. If I see Joe in the locker room or outside the locker room and Travis is not there, and I have a photographer with me at a big event, I'll hold Joe's mic. And I know they would probably do the same for me. So, you know, it's yeah, it's competitive for sure. And, you know, Travis, and, you know, he's like my direct competition because he's the, you know, the only real, like, full-time sports anchor, TV local, you know, in the market. So, but we're very friendly. Travis was my intern when we were back at Fox back a thousand years ago. So I'd do anything for him. And I know the same is true for Travis as well. So, and I honestly, guys, I think if you're just yourself, you're a real person, you care about other people, even though they're the competition, I think ultimately it's going to help you in the long run anyway. There's always going to be that time when you need somebody, something happens. And, you know, it's, we're only on this earth for so long. And, you know, yes, it's competitive, but, you know, people are going to watch who they're going to watch anyway. You know, so if they're loyal 13 viewers, they're going to watch us. If they're loyal Channel 8 or Channel 6 viewers, they're going to watch their station. I totally understand that. I totally get it. And I appreciate that. But I'm not going to change who I am for the sake of ratings, to burn a bridge or anything like that. That's just not me.
Yeah, and anything for me, like, I used to just flick to all three. If I knew that all three of you back in the day were covering a TA event, I'd be like, all right, quick. And it would stink because you guys, like, if it was a big game, it'd always be first. So it's trying to figure out who had the best highlights. But it's almost because there's so few of you now in the market. Before, you said there were probably 8, 9, 10 anchors, you know, split up among three stations. And now it's really just you two. You're kind of in it together because both of you succeeding and making sure that stations value high school sports and local sports, I think definitely has an effect on why you've been able to stick it out so long. So it's cool to hear.
Well, yeah, I mean, it is. And you know, where can you go to an event where there's 5,000, 6,000 fans and they're all pulling for the same, you know, they're it's a happy event. So you like to think that management sees that, you know, but it is an uphill battle for us. I can't speak for Channel 8 or 6, but it's an uphill battle here. I mean, you know, trying to get to a multiple events on a Friday night. I'm given a couple shooters for our Friday night football show. But it's a challenge, and it's continues to trend that way. But every day I come in here, I just try to do the best I can.
For sure.
With what I have.
So let's now talk about your book that you just recently published with Gary Stevens, the athletic director at TA, Stolen Season. So obviously the book talks a lot about, the situation with high school sports and sports in Maine during COVID and what that looked like. And so I will first want to ask, when did the idea for the book kind of grow? Was this something that, you and Gary talked about for a long time? Was it something that maybe you just kind of came up with? But where did the idea kind of start, and how did it come to fruition?
Well, Gary's been a longtime friend, and during the pandemic, we would go on these Zoom calls with the MPA, and then they'd go into executive session. So it was like we weren't looking at anything on the screen. And, I'm not the most computer tech savvy guy. So Gary was like my lifeline. And I'll never forget one day they greenlighted all the sports, the MPA Sports Medicine Committee, going into the fall, that fall season. And I'm like, so Gary, what does this mean? Everything's back to normal? Yep. And the next day, Augusta got involved and the brakes were put on, and ultimately the season was lost. At that point, I said, we're going to need to really hammer out a book, because this has been a roller coaster. And I said, the kids have had their season stolen by this mysterious virus from Wuhan, China. And that's how the book came about, Stolen Seasons. And Gary said, yeah, I want to do it with you. So shortly after everything kind of came back to normal, I'm trying to think. It was when we started it. 2021, I think we started it. Maybe roughly shortly after, we met at Panera Bread. We had a coffee, we had lunch, and we started putting down our ideas on a yellow tab. And next thing you know, we started hammering out interviews. I did a lot of Zoom interviews. And for much of it, what I would do is I would do the interview and I'd just forward it to Gary, and he would take it from there. He wrote, I would say, 85, 90% of it. I wrote a couple of the chapters, but I did a lot of the interviews. And Gary's a wordsmith. He loves to write. So he put it all together. And basically, it's a compilation of stories on how Maine sports survived the pandemic, but through a different lens. Each, the Maine Mariners, how they got through it was a little different than how the Portland Sea Dogs got through it, a little different than how the Maine high school athletes got through it. So there's stories of resiliency, stories of survival. We all went through this together. And I think the title is really kind of fitting, because those seasons, even though we're kind of back to normal now, those seasons were stolen and then never coming back. My daughter was a senior at Kent Hill. She was captain of her basketball team. And they played one game the entire season. It was that makeshift tournament that a bunch of athletic directors in Central Maine had put together. And they did such a good job. They ended up playing the top seed, Halldale. So they played one game her senior season. And very similar stories for kids all over across the state of Maine that had their seasons taken away from them. So it was very, very unfortunate. It was a dark time. I say, and this book is not a dark book, but it's a book, I think, that it's like a timepiece. Mm-hmm. and it reminds us how when we all work together, we can get to the other side together. And that's really kind of what it is.
Yeah, I'm interested too, because as you talk through those stories, I think there are a lot of unknowns from people who lived through that era who aren't in the media or athletic directors that blame, not blame COVID on anybody, of course, but the fact that we had that start stop, the fact that some states that we saw were doing sports, maybe they weren't doing full in school, but they're doing outside sports before we were. There's a perception, whether it's fair or not, that, you know, between the principals, the athletic directors themselves, politicians in Augusta, unnecessarily kept things closed or called off a little bit longer. Does the book talk about that really at all? Is it really just more anecdotal anthology stories? And what do you say to someone who's out there saying, like, these guys don't know what they're talking about? They, you know, in hindsight, they basically just stole, like you said, stole these seasons when, yeah, we didn't know exactly what COVID was going to be, but other states were just fine doing outdoor sports before we were doing them.
Well, we constantly heard throughout this whole thing, follow the science, we're following the science. I don't know if that's in fact true, but we did. We did. There's a talk in that book, the Let Them Play movement, where a lot of the parents and the kids went to Augusta with signs and really wanted to play. It was a really tough time because I honestly think now, you know, looking back and knowing what I know, you know, I can honestly tell you the MPA did everything in their power to get the kids back on the field. I'll leave it at that. So they did the best, and the athletic directors and the coaches, same thing. They did yeoman's work. They really did. And I think at the very beginning, guys, this was a virus we didn't really know a lot about. But I think as time went on, one of the things we did learn real quickly is that high school kids really weren't affected by mm-hmm. the coronavirus. The weirdest thing, it was attacking the senior citizens, the elderly. You know, my mom's in her 80s, you know, we were worried about her, and you know, my mother-in-law, and you know, grandmothers and grandfathers all over the place. But really the young athletes weren't affected by coronavirus that much. So, but as we, you know, as we finally got back to normal, I think we learned a lot more about the pandemic and you know, now we can always play Monday morning quarterback.
Right.
And that's what we do. But I think it was a bit long. I really do. I mm-hmm. think the isolation part of it, I think has done a lot of damage, to be honest with you, with the kids.
It's so obviously, you know, we, as you've mentioned, and as we all know, COVID had a huge impact on local high school sports. But I want to ask, you know, how did it affect your work at WGME? You know, was this a massive change of responsibilities, a massive change of how you had to go about, you know, shooting video and doing your daily jobs? Or was it something that you almost adapted to quickly, or was it something that took a long time?
That's a great question. I was the first guinea pig to go home, back to my house, to do the sports from my living room. And at the time, I was using an app on my phone, and I would put my phone on this little tripod, and I would do the sports that way, and it looked horrible. I mean, there's no other way to really. So finally, they upgraded me to my camera, the camera that I use to shoot games. Came to Litchfield, and we put it on the tripod. I got all the cables. They had me on FaceTime and showed me what to do, hook it up, blah, blah, blah. And the broadcast looked a little better, but of course, you have no teleprompter. You have no really anything. I was going out shooting stories in the beginning. I was shooting like disc golf stories and regular golf stories with my cell phone. And I would feed the video back to the station. They would cut it up here. They didn't want anyone being at the station. We were all isolated in our own, you know, even to this day, the news car, I drive the one of the Subarus out there. And that is, it's not mine technically, but it's my vehicle. When I'm at work, that's the one I use to this day. Originally, it was just COVID. It's like you drive your own car. No one drives other cars, and you know, touch the steering wheel, and that, you know, it was crazy. I mean, it was to think about some of the things we did. It really almost brings back nightmares, to be honest with you. I remember a time my mother-in-law came to visit, and my son was out in the backyard with a tape measure, 6 feet between the chairs. Do you know when that was, that whole 6 foot rule thing came about? It was like 1918.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted
the Spanish flu. Yeah.
The Spanish flu. I'm like, we haven't advanced in 100 years. We can't figure this out better than 6 feet. We're still going with that. So it was bad. It was really bad.
As we kind of wrap up here in the next couple minutes, I want to give you a chance to talk about what's one thing you'd want readers to take away from your book, and maybe even share not a full story from the book, but maybe an example of something that they would read, an anecdote that they could see in this book that everyone should read, because anybody who lived that era and loves sports, I mean, it wasn't just high school. I mean, the book is a lot of high school, but it's other schools as well, other leagues as well.
I'll tell you one story. It involved the Maine Mariners and Ben Gitte, who's really the star of the book because he's all over the book. He was at Maine, you know, as an assistant with Red, the late Red Gendron, and then he came down to coach the Maine Mariners. When Ben was the coach of the Mariners and they just started getting back to playing hockey, they went up to Quebec City. Well, one of their players, Kelty Jerry Leon, tested positive. So they put him in, they isolated him in a hotel room up in Quebec. The Mariners went out, played a game that night. They had to leave him in the hotel room. It's right around Christmas time. So the bus goes back to Portland. Ben gets in his SUV, goes to Kmart or one of the places, gets a shower curtain, puts it in the back, almost like a, you know, like a divider. He goes all the way back to Three Rivers. He gets Kelty out of the hotel room. Kelty's got a mask on. We have pictures of this too. He's got a mask on. I think he's got like swimming goggles. Ben's fully masked up. They got the windows down in the middle of winter in Quebec. Windows down, the heat cranking. They get to customs, and the guys, they couldn't get him through fast enough. They're like, go. They drove. He drove Kelty back to Maine in a blizzard, and every day Kelty was in his apartment holed up for 14 days. Ben would bring him dinner and leave it outside his apartment door. Stories like that it's just unbelievable. Those are things that people, you know, we didn't know, and
right.
And getting information was so hard back then anyway. So stories like that, Ben Gitte, who is not only a phenomenal hockey figure in the state of Maine, just a wonderful, wonderful human being.
So just to finish up, first, I want you to tell the viewers where they can find the book, where they can buy it. And then a little fun question. Give me one game or maybe looking ahead in the spring season for high school sports that you're looking forward to either watching or covering.
All right. Well, you can go to www.stolenseasons.com. That's our webpage. There you can, Tower Publishing has the books. They're available. I think Nonesuch Books in South Portland has them. We're trying to get into Sherman's as we speak. And Amazon as well also has the book. So we really appreciate it. Honestly, guys, if we don't even break even or make a dime on the book, it was a labor of love. And I honestly, Gary and I are both proud at how it came out, and you know, the testimonials we got from Susan Collins to Jeremy Swayman. So it was really, a lot of fun to put together. One event that I'm really looking forward to, you know, off the top of my head, I always love the high school state tournaments, and so far down the road, I'd have to say maybe opening day at Hadlock. Once it does happen, it's always one of my favorites to be out in the ballpark, to wear a winter coat, and to be all bundled up and talk baseball. There's nothing better, and only in Maine.
Only exactly. In Maine. Well, last question as we let you go, Dave. Cooper Flagg, we talked about him earlier in our podcast today. Now that the Duke season's over, we can start thinking about what he's going to look like in blue. Where, in your mind, does he rank as of now, we don't know what he's going to do. We assume he's going to, you know, go to the NBA at some point. Where does he rank in terms of athletes that you saw at the high school level, not just in basketball, Nick Cannon-Redley, Walter Phillips, you know, some other guys, but overall, all athletes that we've ever seen, where does he rank for you? And the you know, the buzz that was around him for that year was magical.
I think he's at the top. I really do. For a long time, Brian Dumoulin, I got to see Brian's first practice as a, he was either a freshman or sophomore at Biddeford.
Yeah.
And I left that practice and I was like, oh my goodness, this kid is going very far. And turns out he's still playing in the NHL today.
Yeah.
But to see Cooper Flagg, when I saw him at, you know, when he came to Portland, of course, I was watching him at the Nokomis, when Nokomis won the state championship. The one thing about Cooper in that Nokomis game that struck me was his court vision. And he reminded me of a very young Giannis Antetokounmpo, because everything ran through Cooper. And he was, you know, the tallest kid out there, but he was the best passer. He had the best vision. He could attack the rim better than anyone. And when he came to Maine with Mount Verde Academy, I think he could play in the NBA today. And that's, I mean, that's, you know, he's going to be a lottery pick. No questions asked. He's that good. He's that talented. He's still ascending. It's amazing to watch him do what he's done. It's astounding. I would have to say he's at the top of the mountain right now. And by the way, he's in the book as well.
Oh, interesting. Okay, we'll look forward to that. Well, we appreciate Dave, and I'll let you just give a little plug here at the end. Where can people see you? Whether it's 10 o'clock, 11 o'clock, where can they see you on the news on a weekly, nightly basis?
Yep, 6 and 11 o'clock, WGME Channel 13. And then at 10 o'clock on Fox 23, we own the both. So people have a choice. You know, the 10 o'clock news, a lot of people love because they don't like to get to bed too late. So right. It's been a big hit. But, you know, Channel 13 has been home for a very long time, going on 29 years now.
Wow. Insane. Well, Dave, we appreciate your time. Good luck with the book, and we'll definitely see you on the sidelines sometime here in the spring.
Guys, thank you so much for having me. It's been an honor to be on your podcast, and really appreciate it.
I want to thank Dave Eat again for coming in for that interview. Always great to talk to him. Really cool to have him on, especially early on in our couple of episodes here for the Maine Rundown. But as always, finishing up the episode with the take that has nothing to do with sports, I'll go first. Mine is something I spent a lot of time thinking about what I want to talk about this week, and I didn't think I was going to talk about this, but I will now. If you don't know, Dave Portnoy, one of the most influential people right now when it comes to media and sports with Barstool Sports, rescued a dog about a month and a half ago. And this dog has taken the world, the social media world, and the world by storm. Mrs. Peaches.
Miss Peaches.
Is it? Oh, yeah. Miss Peaches. And my take is that I know that a lot of people think it's corny. They think it's like, okay, she's got her own Instagram page that has like 300,000 followers already. But to me, I think this is the greatest thing on social media right now. I think for two reasons, I'll give my two reasons and then I'll let you, clearly I could see it that you want to rebuttal that statement.
Just go.
First off, super cute dog. Love me some quality dog content. And you can't tell me that it's not funny when like this dog is like eating his hats, and they were in the ER because I think the dog ate a pack
bubble gum or something. Yeah.
Yes. Pack of gum or something. But there's two reasons why. First off, this goes to show you how quick you can make it on social media these days. The dog's account has 300,000 followers, roughly, on Instagram within weeks of it being made. And the content is super easy to make. Anybody can make it. That's just one point. And the second point I have is that, at least the way I've always looked at it, is a lot of people don't like Dave Portnoy because they think he's this big businessman who doesn't care about anybody. He only cares about Barstool Sports. They see him as just like sort of somebody that they can't connect to because he's just so different. And I think that this Miss Peach's content humanizes is not the right word, but I think really allows people to connect with him, shows that he's just a guy who loves his dog and is super chill and cares about his dog. I mean, he spoils the heck out of that dog, and it's super cute to see. And I like that for him. I think it's good content for Barstool Sports. I think it's the greatest thing on social media right now. And I don't think you can have any other point than just to say that you don't like it.
Okay. So I don't disagree with everything you said. I think what you hit the nail on the head, he's a businessman. Like, this is, you know, I love Dave. I'm a stoolie. I love Barstool. I watch so much content. Mm-hmm. I listen to some of the podcasts. I don't listen to that many podcasts, but in general, but I watch a lot of Barstool content. And look, Dave is a genius when it comes to marketing and Barstool. I don't feel like this is much different. I'm not saying he's faking it for the dog. I'm not, because no one would get on there and the way he talks to it. It's just, first of all, I don't want to have to see it. Like, I think it should be so far away from Barstool. It still pops up on my feed because some of the other stuff that El Prez tweets I like and I get engaged with. And then this other stuff comes in here as well when I'm scrolling on TikTok. Miss Peaches always shows up. And it's just like the doggy voice. I can't stand it. I'm not saying the dog is bad. I mean, obviously the dog has had a horrible life and he's doing a great thing for it. But it's like, obviously, it's partly, you know, I'm not saying he adopted it for the marketing, but it's certainly, now that it's kind of blown up, it is a marketing tool for him to get a new audience into the Barstool lineup to do exactly what you just said. Sure. Is humanize him. Let's spend, you know, let's make content, buy an $8,000 dog bowl, which is what he did a couple weeks ago. And it's like, okay, I get it. And now, but it's just like, it's creeping so much into his normal Barstool stuff that's where I'm like, okay, I'm not saying that people should not follow. Mm-hmm. If you're, you know, I don't want to generalize people, but if you're someone who just likes dog content or whatever, that's not me at all. Go for it. Like, have at it. Go for it. But don't, you know, I don't want to have to deal with it. It's just, I don't want it to become like that's his only thing. But I feel like it will be, because he's going to make so much money off this dog. No, he's using it to raise money for other shelter dogs. That's great. But like, I just can't watch it because the voice is so annoying. Okay.
So
I just want to blow my brains out.
I do get the, I know the voice, his voice with the Miss Peaches.
Miss Peaches ate my shoe. Oh my gosh. I get it. And he's playing a character. He's the best of the best at it. I just wish I could watch him on mute. I can't do it.
I don't know if you've seen someone, like, people were making like parody videos where it's like, cause Miss Peaches kept doing a bunch of like bad things. And it was like the parody was like, oh, Miss Peaches, where'd you get these nuclear launch codes?
I haven't seen those.
They're so funny. But I'm just going to, my last point here is that we're never going to know why he really did adopt this dog. If it was 100% just so he could market himself and make a lot of money. I would like to think, and I will continue to think, that his first thought is I'm going to adopt this dog that has a horrible life, and because I want companionship, I want to help the dog. And then his second thought was, while I'm
good here, content. Oh yeah, 100%.
But I'm going to continue to think and say, you know, that he did it for the dog originally because he's a good person. I think he's a good person in general. I don't think he's a bad guy. So I'm gonna go with that thought. And then the second thought was, okay, let me market this a little bit and make some money.
I think what frustrates me the most besides the voice is the name. I think if the dog's name was, you know, Maria, that would be so much better than Miss Peaches. It's just, oh my gosh. He's a genius though. I mean, whatever. He turned nothing into millions, probably millions of dollars. So good for him. I just can't stand it. Okay. So my take has nothing to do with sports, is also a kind of entertainment. You know, we there's a ton of different streaming services out there now, Netflix, Hulu, Paramount Plus, Peacock TV, even more than that. We've talked about some of them here. I finally gave Apple TV Plus a run out. I'd done maybe a free trial or something in the past. But Apple TV Plus has just disappointed me. Here's why. So obviously everyone knows it for Ted Lasso. I think Ted Lasso is a fine show. It's a good show. I didn't find it as amazing. I'm a big soccer fan. So for me, it's a little bit too touchy-feely for me, but I get it, whatever. Mm-hmm. So I bought it recently for a few reasons. I wanted to watch Napoleon, the movie with, I forget the guy's name now. The guy who played the Joker, he was playing Napoleon. I'll think of it.
Joaquin Phoenix.
Joaquin Phoenix. Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to watch Napoleon. I wanted to watch Masters of Air. I wanted to watch some other things like Dynasty, the Patriots one, and Manhunt. I watched Napoleon. It was a Ridley Scott movie. It was good. It wasn't great. I think there's actually a potentially like a 4-hour director's cut. I'd love to see that actually, because this is like 2 hours and 40 minutes and it glazed over a little too much. So it was good. I mean, it was okay, right? I wasn't blown away. Mm-hmm. I watched 2 episodes of Dynasty and I couldn't watch any more of it. I mean, I just, those 2 episodes are fine, but from everything else I heard from the former players, I just, pathetic. Like, it's just such an anti-Bill slant. I couldn't watch it. So, and I thought the production quality was okay.
Ruins your image of the Patriots. And you're like, I'm not doing this anymore. I'm not going to let these guys change what I think about this.
No, exactly. I'm not going to enjoy that. So whatever. And then lastly, I watched Manhunt. I haven't watched Masters of Air yet. Manhunt, which is a story about Abraham Lincoln's assassination. I was blown away how bad it was. I watched 2 episodes and I kept thinking, does this suck? I think this sucks, but maybe I'm going to give it. So then I'm like midway through the 3rd episode. I looked on IMDb and on stuff and people agree with me. It sucks. There's like 1 or 2 decent actors in it. The rest of the actors are terrible, like terrible casting. Patton Oswalt is one of the main characters as a supposed to be a serious Union general or Union soldier. Patton Oswalt, who's a fine comedic actor, but whatever. The scenes, like there's really obvious fake CGI in the background. It's just really bad. I hate watching it now, so I just want to get through it, but just so disappointing. It looked like you're watching something on the History Channel. Right. Just like, and like, this is Apple TV Plus. They're supposed to make a lot of money. So anyway, I haven't watched Master of Air. I'm just overall underwhelmed by the Apple TV Plus. And those are the shows that they are putting up front. These aren't like deep dive shows. These are like, watch these shows. So I'm a little disappointed so far.
Yeah. Similar take on Apple TV Plus. I got it originally for Ted Lasso. I thought Ted Lasso was a solid show, not anything out of this world. I thought that for out of shows that have to do with sports, it had the most accurate of, like, in terms of like when they were playing soccer, it looked the most realistic to me, which was cool. And then I watched a ton of other stuff, didn't like it. Only other show, if you still have it, watch The Morning Show. The plot behind that is really good. It's Steve Carell is, you know, a guy on a super popular, it's like Good Morning Today, basically, in a random world. And he gets fired. And this, it's all about the new person that comes in. But it's really good acting. It's got Jennifer Aniston in it and Reese Witherspoon. Really, really good.
I've heard Severance is really good, too. Severance. Two people have told me Severance is good. So I'll have to watch that one before my – I bought it for 1 month and I have like 3 weeks left and then I'm done. Yeah.
But you start to see that, like, a lot of these platforms, like Apple TV Plus, have a couple of good movies, a couple of good shows. They get some good features. But overall, they don't have everything else. Like Netflix, Hulu, some of these bigger ones, they have a bunch of good comedy shows, good rom-com movies, good action movies that aren't the popular ones that people go back and watch. I like that. I like having other things to watch than just the feature shows. But Apple TV Plus is not my thing. Napoleon, my one issue with it was is that I think that they could have – this could have been a huge movie. I don't think they market it well. I didn't even know that they were making it until it came out. And I would like to see it. I haven't seen it yet, but seems like it should have been something super big where it wasn't. But that's how streaming services are these days. Every company wants to make one, and they're going to, and they're all going to be shows are moving back and forth. The Office to Netflix to Paramount to NBC. It's everything like that. It's just wild. But that is going to do it for episode number 5 of the Main Rundown podcast. As always, follow us on X and Instagram at Main Rundown Pod. Be on the lookout for some more content in the future. Want to thank Dave Eat again for coming in for that interview. Thank Jeff as well for joining me. And Jeff, hopefully the weather isn't too bad in Maine, and hopefully my train will make it to Saco, and I will be up there this weekend.
Great.
We'll see how the weather goes. But that's going to do it for episode number 5, and we will see you all next week.